As the saying goes, sometimes fact is stranger than fiction. And when you take a closer look at the history of medicine, like our guest did today, that's definitely the case. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are going to have a fun and informative program with Erica Janik, as we always do when she comes in. She's a historian, author of many books, most recently, Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine. She writes frequently for the Wisconsin Magazine of History and other publications, also a producer for the Wisconsin Life segments that you and I enjoy on both networks of Wisconsin Public Radio. Erica, a real treat to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I even turned your microphone on.
It's such a treat that now you can hear me.
And happy birthday.
Oh, thank you.
Today is the big day.
Today is my birthday. It's true.
Well, I'm glad to have you here on your birthday. And I'm really happy to tell you that I really enjoyed your book. It's a wonderful book. You're such an engaging writer. Don't blush. I mean, you're a wonderful writer, and I have not finished the entire book, but I've gotten through a good share of it, and I'm really enjoying it. How did you come to write Marketplace of the Marvelous?
Well, it really began kind of as something else, which is often the case, right? Mm-hmm. You think you know what you're going to do, and then you start looking into it, and you're like, no, this is not actually what I'm going to do. So it kind of began in two different places. Maybe 6 years ago, my husband sent me an article from the Journal of the American Medical Association that was... they have a history section, and it was congratulating the state of Wisconsin for finally capturing the Reinhardt brothers. And so he forwards me this email, and he says, I wonder who the Reinhardt brothers are.
And Willis and Wallace.
Good question. I don't really know. Exactly. So we ended up writing an article together for the Magazine of History about those brothers. But in the process of doing that research, I really just started looking more into what was going on in medical history in the 19th century. And I was really realizing that the story that I thought I knew, you know, the quack doctors mm-hmm. passing off alcohol and opium as drugs, as, you know, doctors who are valiantly trying to protect our health, that story wasn't quite mm-hmm. what I was finding in the history books. You know,
sure.
The things were a little bit more muddled than that. And so that's one of the places that this began. And then the other place is I was digging through a bunch of family documents, and I happened to unroll this tube, and I found this paper in there that said that my great-grandmother was a water cure doctor. And I was like, I have a personal connection to this. I had absolutely no idea that that's what she had done for work. And it was funny, I asked my mom about it, and she was so, like, matter of fact, as though it's perfectly normal for your great-grandmother to have been a water cure doctor. But, you know, so it was kind of those two things coming together that led to this book.
Well, it's a fascinating book. And, you know, I think you're opinions kind of changed over time. The state of medicine and in general in the 19th century, I mean, we really have to kind of view it through the eyes of the people who lived at that time, do we not?
We do. And, you know, and I think that's where we get that idea of, you know, these quacks kind of duping, kind of gullible or ignorant people. But if you really put yourself in the mindset of someone in the 19th century, we really knew very little about how the body worked. We didn't know about germs. We didn't know about bacteria. We didn't know that human contact could spread disease. And so there were all different kinds of theories about what caused disease and how to cure it. And so people... like we do today, they just want to be well, and we're really willing to try whatever we can in order to get that way.
Mm-hmm. And we still do that today, as a matter of fact. I mean, there's...
Absolutely. There's still tons of holes in our knowledge about medicine and our bodies and, you know, lots of different people offering theories and certain cures. And, you know, we all want to feel better. No one wants to be sick. And so we're willing to try things. We're willing to... take a chance on something because we hope to feel better.
I think there were a lot of reasons for people to say, to prefer irregular medicine, let's say, over regular medicine. I think one is just distance from a doctor.
That's right. You know, in the U.S., the population was really far, really spread out all over the place. And so there just weren't enough doctors in this country. Doctors tended to be more concentrated in urban areas, and we just didn't have very many of them. And so people were often living very, very far away from where there would be a trained medical doctor. And so they really were looking for something a little closer to home, something that was cheaper, something that they could potentially treat themselves with, because what other options did they really have? They didn't have any options. And so these irregular healers, that's what they were known as. We think of them as alternative today, but in the 19th century, they were known as irregular. And so there were all kinds of people that were kind of trying to help people that were living out in more remote frontier areas, coming up with ways that they could just treat themselves.
And the if you were close enough, this issue of regular medicine, there were some pretty
hair-raising.
Heavy-handed, could we say, hair-raising, treatments that when you're done, you weren't dead, but maybe.
Maybe pretty close.
But you wish you were.
Exactly. Regular medicine at the time, that's what we think of as mainstream medicine today, they practiced a form of medicine that was known as heroic. Now, heroic doesn't mean it's, a superhero flying in with a cape on to blast out medicine and cure you. They were called heroic because it was of the great magnitude of the effect that their treatments would have. So they would bleed you, they would blister, sweat, vomiting. These were the standard medical treatments. And they were using a theory that was about 2,000 years old that went all the way back to Galen, who was a Roman physician. And he believed that your body needed to be in balance. When your body was out of balance, he based it on the four humors. And that kind of developed over time and took different forms. But the idea of a body imbalance was still very, very current in 1800. And so the way to get your body back in balance, to restore that, was to do one of these very dramatic interventions like bleeding or blistering or sweating. And they caused, if you had a fever and they bled you, things would definitely change. And that change was interpreted as progress by the doctor.
And sometimes they killed him.
They did sometimes do that. They didn't mean to, though. I do want to make clear that I don't want to demonize any of these people. People really were trying to do the best they could with the knowledge that was available at the time. So no one was setting out to. At least I hope not. Not in all cases.
Oh, man. Erica Janik, our guest, she is the author of many books, including the one we're talking about today, Marketplace of the Marvelous: The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine. And you may be curious about the origins of modern medicine and what we now call alternative medicine. Or maybe you wonder about the story behind chiropractic medicine or something like phrenology. All those things we can talk about with our guest today, and you can join in. Maybe you've had an experience, too, with yourself or with a relative that might be kind of interesting to share along these lines. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. And certainly we'd love to hear from you. Women, women were often involved in really the care and doctoring, were they not?
They were. Long before we had that idea of that marketers have kind of popularized of Dr. Mom, that was really what women were doing and had been doing for centuries. Women were really their family's primary caretakers. They were acting as the nurse, the doctor, the pharmacist. They were often mixing different medications, using herbs and other plants that were growing in the yards. And so women were really very, very responsible for their family's health. And it's really only as we kind of get this more professional medical field in the late 18th century, early 19th century in the U.S. that a lot of that medical care that women had been providing for centuries all of a sudden goes to these kind of professional doctors.
Mm-hmm.
But something that does happen with these irregular groups that start springing up in the 19th century is that they give women professional opportunities. Women are allowed to be doctors, irregular medicine doctors, and they're very welcomed into that field. One of the things I was so surprised to learn is that in the 19th century, medicine was second only to teaching as the most popular profession for women.
Is that right?
Yeah, isn't that shocking?
I can't remember. Oh, I guess I didn't read it. I read it and didn't register with me, but that's really interesting.
Yeah, I just thought it was just so fascinating that women had really taken this role that they'd really been playing for centuries. And then as they found these professional opportunities, they really just seized them, and that they were so interested in practicing medicine.
Well, let's take some calls. If you'd like to join us, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And let's turn to Marianne and Kashina. Marianne, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I think it's really fascinating all the influences and the impact that the Native Americans have made on modern day pharmacology and just treatment in general, and to this day continue to be used very effectively. I just find that very fascinating.
Anna, thank you for calling, because that's something you actually bring up in your book.
Absolutely. You know, botanical healing was very, very popular in the 1700s and 1800s. And a lot of the plants that were growing in the New World, when explorers started coming over here, they were encountering all different kinds of plants that they didn't know anything about. And actually, one of the kind of missions of the Virginia Company sent over by England was actually to find new medicinal plants, because they knew a lot about the plants that were growing in Europe and Asia, and they were really hoping that they could find some new blockbuster drug in North America. And one of the ways that they learned a lot about it was from the native people who had been mm-hmm. using a lot of these plants as remedies for centuries here. And so they did contribute a whole lot to early pharmacology in the colonies, teaching people about plants and the healing properties of various things that we had never encountered before. And this became a very integral part of a lot of medicine in the 19th century.
Yeah, very interesting. Thanks, Marianne. Appreciate your call. You know, Samuel Thompson comes to mind now because he promoted the use of botanical medicines in the early 19th century. And so, of course, it wasn't a new concept because of the Native Americans, but he did some things that were different. What did he do that was different?
Yeah, so Samuel Thompson was kind of building on something that had been kind of common at the time. It was even kind of coming into mainstream medicine, too, was the idea of using botanical plants as medicine. But what Samuel Thompson did is he was kind of a self-trained herbalist. He had learned everything from his family's herb doctor. He had just followed this woman around. Her name was Mrs. Benton. And he just learned what she would pick up and what she would use it for. And he just began kind of experimenting himself, trying different plants and just seeing what the results would be. Some of them to kind of ill effect. he happened to swallow some lobelia, which is known to make you vomit, which he actually thought was kind of funny at the time. He would give some to some of his friends and just laugh as they grew up. But when he grew up and became a little bit more mature, he actually developed a whole system of healing based on these botanic remedies. And it involved only 6 easy steps that he figured anyone could follow. And it was all based on using plants and barks. But the thing that he also did that was really unique but very American, and when we think about it in retrospect, is that he basically franchised his business.
Yeah.
Early 19th century, he realized the country is too big for me to get out there and heal everyone myself. So he kind of set up these agents who would kind of buy into his system. I mean, it's just like, you know, getting your own McDonald's or something. Mm-hmm. And then you could have your own independent Thompsonian practice. And he spread this all over the country. And it really, millions of people practice his system of medicine. And it was very popular in the frontier areas because, you know, as we already said, people often lived very far away from the doctor.
Yep.
So if there was a possibility that they could just buy something that would have all the remedies they needed to treat everything, that was going to be very, very popular.
And he was really... He really believed, I think, in empowering people to treat themselves, did he not?
He absolutely did. That becomes a kind of a common refrain among all of these irregular healers, is that like they're kind of seizing on that American independence, that spirit of doing things yourself. You know, that's been very common in the U.S. since colonial days, that we want to do things ourselves. And so he really took it on as his personal mission to make every man his own doctor. That was one of his phrases he kept repeating over and over again, because he really just wanted to give people the tools so they could treat themselves, because he thought that doctors were kind of evil and elitist, that they were just keeping all of their knowledge to themselves and not making it open and accessible. So he made sure that everything that he wrote was in kind of simple language that was easy to understand. One of the fun things that he did that I think is kind of interesting is he actually wrote about his medicine in poem form.
Yes.
there are hundreds of these poems, and it's just fascinating. And lots of them are kind of like instructions for use. He would basically be telling you how to actually take his 6-step remedies. If you just memorize the poem, then you would be able to follow his system. And he also used these poems, though, to kind of rail against bleeding and blistering, which he thought were horrible, horrible forms of medicine and were just more likely to kill you than help you. And so there's lots of poems about that are kind
of... And he was right.
It was about that.
He was, yes.
Oh, man. Erica Janik, our guest today, having a lot of fun with her, talking about the origins of modern medicine, her book, Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine. Callers online, but there's a line open for you yet. Maybe you have a question at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page. Go to The Larry Mehler Show. I'm Larry Mehler. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up about 11:45 today. Please stay tuned for that, because we'll be visiting with one of the speakers at this week's Darwin Day event. This year's theme is Alien Invasions, Evolution of Real Live Body Snatchers. That was perfectly with our topic here.
I love it.
With Erica. Oh, right now we're talking with Erica Janik about her new book, Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine. And there were, you know, there was some body snatching that didn't go on back in the day. I mean, digging people up.
That's right. That's actually, you know, how a lot of medical students would learn about human anatomy, is that they would go visit the local graveyard and dig some people up. And, you know, that's actually what the cadavers that they would use in their medical school classes. And it was very, very controversial, as you can imagine. And actually, there's a story in New York in the 18th century. There was actually something called the Doctor's Riot that started after a little boy supposedly looked in the window, and a guy who was doing a dissection on this cadaver, like, lifted the arm up and waved it at the little boy. And the little boy ran home and told his dad what he had seen, and his mother had happened to have just died. And they supposedly went to the graveyard, dug her up. She wasn't there. And so people were just outraged, and they just descended on the building. They actually had to call in basically the equivalent of the National Guard to kind of break this up. And this happened in cities all over the East Coast. But grave robbing went on for medical practice into the 19th century.
Amazing. Neil in Toma, we'll give you a chance next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. My father told me a tale of his life in Rosendale when his father, who's a German immigrant, told him one day that he had to come with him because he was suffering from a horrible back injury that was pretty much immobilizing him. And he said he wanted to keep an eye on things, make sure he was safe. And my father didn't really understand what was happening. So they got in the wagon and they rode to a local mechanic in the area, who was a short, stocky German with huge, fat, stubby, greasy hands. And he cleaned off the bench, and my grandfather was laid down on it with his shirt off. And my father sat on a stool in the corner, young enough still, he was just swinging his feet, wondering what was going on. And they took shot glasses and laid them on my grandfather's back, and then he come out with a razor blade and a jar of alcohol, and he'd take a match and he'd quick slice a spot on his back and pull the match on the shot glass to make a suction laid on there until he had a number of shot glasses that all filled up with blood. They'd pull out a deck of cards and slide the card underneath and quick move it away, and after he had bled him sufficiently, let him go off and prescribe to come back a week later. This is in Rosendale, Wisconsin.
Wow. Oh, man.
Do you know what year that was?
Yeah, there was my eyes wide. I couldn't believe what was happening.
What year was that, Neil? Do you know?
Well, if my father was born in 1919, he was probably, you know, 8 years old.
All right, so 27. Yeah, okay.
Wow. I mean, that's a very old form of I mean, that does sound a lot like 19th century medicine. The cupping was very common, using the cups to kind of raise the blood to the surface, and then they would kind of make an incision, and that would help with the bleeding because they thought that that would get the disease out of your body. It's interesting that they went to the mechanic to get this done. Sounds like he might have been using some medical books that were a few decades too old, because medical practice had evolved quite a bit by that time. It was pretty rare to find people doing bloodletting as a matter of course by the 20th century. But that sounds like a frightening experience.
Oh, man. Yeah. You've described it pretty well, Neil.
Wow.
Thanks. Well, weren't barbers? Didn't barbers do this too? So
they did. Yeah. You know, they were really the surgeons, were these barber surgeons, and because surgery wasn't a very common medical practice that doctors were really doing until the late 19th century. I mean, there were doctors doing various things, but you could get surgery from all kinds of different people that you wouldn't think of going to get some surgery from today.
Oh, man. Well, let's go to Rose in the Cedar next. Rose, hi. Thank you for calling.
I had asked if I came into the show late, and I'd asked if you'd addressed acupuncture yet, but I'll try to make this story short. At the end of December in 08, I was out walking the dog early, and I fell down, and there was ice underneath the snow, and I thought that I had just, like, maybe dislocated my elbow or something, and it turns out I had to have surgery because I broke the bone off in my left elbow, and the surgeon, he put me in a cast for a couple months, and when he took it off, he had made a joke about golfing with Tiger Woods, and I thought that was just a temporary problem that I wouldn't be able to golf. But he said, no, this is permanent. It's like, what are you saying? My arm was at a right angle. My left arm was at a right angle, and I was a lefty. I was born a lefty. My dad made me be a right. So my right arm wore out because I was used to using my left arm for a lot of things. And so that was the prognosis, and I tried physical therapy. That didn't help at all, of course. And then I started with acupuncture. And then in the course, I talked to a lawyer, and he wanted a second opinion. And I went to see an elbow expert up in Duluth, and he was horrified at the surgery and the cast for 2 months. But he said there was a bone chip in the middle, and that was why I couldn't bend my elbow. Well, this acupuncture I worked for at the time, we started with acupuncture, and then he said, was that a bone chip or was that a calcium deposit? And I said, well, I don't know. And he said, well, either way, you need magnesium to absorb that bone chip. And so I started with the magnesium too. I have 99% use in my arm.
Well, good for you. So acupuncture, does acupuncture come into your book at all?
It doesn't, in part because acupuncture has obviously been practiced for centuries, thousands of years, actually. I don't talk about it in my book because it really doesn't come to the United States in any great popularity until the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And this is in part because there's kind of as medical science starts to advance in the late 19th century, early 20th century, you find a lot of these irregular therapies kind of start to die down a little bit. Interest in them goes away. People are putting a lot more faith in mainstream medicine. There's just a lot of changes that are going on. But about the 50s or 60s, people become more interested in alternative medicine again. That's actually when it starts to get the name alternative rather than irregular medicine. And that's when you start to find a lot of these therapies used all over the world, including acupuncture, start coming to the United States in greater force. So the ones that I mostly talk about are the ones that were very, very popular in the 19th century, at a time when medicine was in a lot of turmoil in the U.S., when it was really kind of still trying to find its way. And what happened in the 20th century is just a little bit different.
Yeah, it is. I just one final word on acupuncture, and that was, I think that really got popularized when Scotty Reston of the New York Times was in China and had appendicitis.
Yep.
And they used acupuncture, and he obviously wrote about it, and that really kind of help make it sort of mainstream.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think that's something that you find with a lot of these treatments, no matter what century or what kind you're looking at. It's really that personal experience, someone telling you about what happened to them and how it worked and how much better they felt. You know, that's what you find in the 19th century. And that's just what you find today, too. And what makes people, you know, willing to try things and what kind of grows movements is kind of this anecdotal evidence builds up a case for these and helps make them more popular.
You can join in with your questions or comments or experiences at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. In some ways, I guess a related but a different in approach is a system called homeopathy.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe talk about that concept.
Yeah, so homeopathy, I think, has kind of a surprising history, I think. You know, when we think about homeopathy today, and this is certainly something that I wasn't necessarily aware of, you know, it doesn't seem like it's posing a great threat to mainstream medicine. There are certainly people that practice homeopathy. But actually, in the 19th century, homeopathy was the biggest threat to mainstream medicine. millions of people used it. They had their own medical schools. They actually converted lots of regular doctors to homeopaths. And so homeopathy began with a regular doctor in Europe. His name was Samuel Hahnemann. And he was trained as a doctor, was practicing, but he'd become a little bit disillusioned with all of the bleeding and blistering. And so he just started kind of reading around, looking to see what else was out there. He actually was considering giving up his career in medicine. And he was reading something, and he saw that this doctor had mentioned that a cure for malaria was this this bark that contained quinine. And the way he was describing it, he was like, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's what happens. And so he started taking it himself just to see what would happen. And within, you know, days, he had basically developed all of the symptoms of malaria. And he stopped taking it, and they went away. And so he came up with this idea that like cures like, that mm-hmm. if you cause the same symptoms in yourself, in a healthy person, and in a sick person, that would cause the disease to go away. And so he starts testing all of these different kinds of medications, all of these different all kinds of things, actually, like plants and bark, and just to see what their effects are on the body. And then he starts also using as small a dose as possible, because he starts to think that, you know, a sick person is, their immune system is kind of suppressed, though he doesn't use those words at the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that sure. they're kind of weak and they can't handle very much. So we probably need to give them as small a dose as possible. And so he starts promoting this idea of like cures like, and these very small doses. And he does all of these tests of all different kinds of plants and flowers, and homeopathy becomes very, very popular in Europe. It's brought to the U.S. in the 1830s, mostly by German immigrants. They start forming schools. They're very welcoming to women. This is one of the fields that women are allowed to be professional doctors in. But one of the things that starts happening to homeopathy by the late 19th century, you know, they really had dozens of medical schools. They were attracting a large middle class clientele. So yeah. they were making a lot of money. So a lot of mainstream medicine was pretty nervous about the threat that homeopathy posed to them. But a lot of them were also very open to the newest medical science. So as we're learning new things about disease, they start incorporating that in. And that kind of homeopathy loses some of the things that make it unique as it starts incorporating some of the germ theory of disease. And so that's kind of what happens to these schools, is that they kind of transition and become almost like mainstream schools by the early 20th century.
Hmm. Joe in Prairie du Chien has a question for you. Hi, Joe. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm curious, what sort of research was going on at this in this time frame, and who was doing it, the universities or private institutions, and what sort of databases were they compiling, and how what sort of access was there?
So most medical research at the time was pretty limited and happening on a person-by-person basis. I don't think there were really any databases. People were publishing books, certainly sharing some of their findings and their experiences.
And you just shared some experience research
yeah,
that was going on.
Right. So Samuel Hahnemann, the homeopath, you know, he was doing all kinds of experiments, both on himself and his friends and neighbors, and other homeopaths were also testing the remedies, and they were keeping very, very careful notes of everything that they were doing. They called these provings. And such careful notes that it was things like a tingling in your left arm was different than a shooting pain in your left arm. And, you know, it was really, really specific. And this was considered the most scientific research that you could do at the time. And mainstream medicine was actually not doing so much research. Mm. They were really, you know, just kind of practicing some of these theories that they'd been doing for centuries. And we were certainly learning more things about the body. But in terms of daily practice, it really wasn't changing all that much. You really don't see mainstream medicine start to change until the late 19th century. So some of the most scientific things that are happening in medicine are actually happening with these irregular therapies who are, you know, they're trying to prove themselves. And so they're doing as many experiments and observational studies as they possibly can to try to build an audience and convince people of the veracity of their ideas.
Lydia Pinkham and her vegetable compound was interesting from a marketing perspective, not just a medical one.
Yeah. So Lydia Pinkham, she had her own compound that was marketed mostly toward women. It wasn't necessarily, you couldn't use it if you were a man, but she was really trying to cure feminine problems. And it was a very highly marketed product. You know, this was what we would think of as a patent medicine, though it wasn't actually patented. People called them patent medicines, but it had secret ingredients. And if you patent something, then you have to reveal the ingredients. So no one wanted to do that. because that secret is what made it work. And she really was just making this compound for her friends and family. She really had no intentions of starting a patent medicine business, but her family fell on hard times. There were several depressions in the 19th century, and they really needed some money, and her sons had suggested, "Mom, you should start selling this stuff." And so it became this kind of family business, and she truly believed that this worked, and they hit on a couple of, you know, pretty innovative marketing techniques, and I think the most innovative one was putting her face on the package.
Yeah.
You know, other products had a face or a person attached to them, but they were all men. So it was really kind of radical to have this kindly woman. She has kind of a bun and she has this lacy collar. And she looks very trustworthy, like your grandma wouldn't hurt you. I mean, that's what she looks like. She's in her 60s when this is coming out. And her image became so popular and so well-known in a way. And there weren't really a lot of images of women. So you would find her same face used to stand in for other women. You know, they didn't have a picture of Queen Victoria. So they just took Lydia Pinkham, and a newspaper editor would say, we'll just label it Queen Victoria. Because there were not images of women in popular circulation at the time. And, you know, they did all kinds of, like, newspaper advertising. She also asked people to send her letters that she would answer personally. And the letters became so vast that she actually did have to hire like a dictation office, basically, because she couldn't keep up with all of them. But a very innovative marketing strategy for the 19th century.
And she made a couple of bucks.
She did make a couple of bucks. It's actually still around today. So.
Oh, man. And Mary Baker Eddy, who's founding of the Christian Science Church, also came out for irregular medicine.
She did, yeah. So she had been pretty much sick her whole life, and she'd been trying to find all different kinds of remedies. And she happened upon the office of a man named Phineas Parkhurst Quimby, and he was a mental healer. Now, he believed that disease was caused by you having bad thoughts. And if he could replace those bad thoughts with good thoughts, then you would be well. And the way he basically did that is he would do a kind of form of hypnosis. And as you were kind of in that trance state, he would suggest happier, better thoughts for you. And then you would emerge from that and you would be healthy. So Mary Baker Eddy, sick her whole life, goes to see him, and she finds herself completely cured. And so she becomes a big acolyte of Quimby and decides that she's going to be basically his, like, publicist. But unfortunately, Quimby dies soon after she decides she's going to do this. And she, you know, doesn't really quite know what she's going to do next. And she has a bad fall on the ice, and she tries to heal herself. And she uses a kind of form of what Quimby had been doing with that mental healing. But she was also really focused on the Bible and reading scriptures. And she kind of merge those two to create Christian Science, which is kind of this religious healing faith. And it is pretty much the largest homegrown healing faith in American history, founded by a woman. And it became wildly popular, also wildly criticized, still to this day. And I think some of the criticism of it had to do with the fact that it was a woman starting this, that she was a powerful woman who was, you know, very outspoken and clear about what she wanted. And so, you know, a lot of the criticism is really personally focused rather than really focused on her theories and ideas.
It was really, really interesting story of her life, for sure. How did irregular medicine really lay the groundwork for modern medicine?
So you find that a lot of these irregular theories are kind of proposing ideas that seem kind of crazy at the time. You know, we've already talked a little bit about what regular medicine was doing at the time with the bleeding and the blistering. And so you find all of these irregular healers coming out, proposing new ideas about what causes disease and how to cure it. You find people like the hydropathist, like my great grandmother, the water cure doctor. You know, they were proposing that for good health, you should drink 8 glasses of water a day. And that you should bathe regularly, and that you should get regular exercise. You know, these things seem like perfectly common sense today, but in the 19th century, these were pretty fringe ideas. You know, it did attract a pretty wide following, hydropathy did take it to kind of an extreme end, you know, the amount of bathing that you did, the amount of water that some people drank. But the idea of good hygiene and drinking water and exercising regularly, you know, become incorporated into public health campaigns in the late 19th century. So regular medicine kind of picks and chooses among these ideas that are being proposed by all these different groups, and they kind of become snowballed into what we think of as modern medicine today. And you'll find that throughout all of these, you know, even phrenology, the idea that, you know, the bumps on your head say something about your personality, which seems a little bit crazy. At the same time, you know, people, when this theory was first proposed, people thought of your brain as one organ. And Gall, who came up with phrenology, proposed that your brain was actually a series of organs and that certain parts of it govern different functions, which is right.
That's exactly right.
So, you know, sometimes, I mean, I think one of the things that I really learned in doing this project is, you know, that sometimes good ideas can come out of wrong places.
Well, I tell you what, this has been a lot of fun. Somebody wondered about cannabis as medicine back in that time period.
You certainly do find people using cannabis as medicine. You know, hemp was in wide circulation in terms of paper in colonial America. Lots of people were growing it. You know, people didn't necessarily know about all of the properties of it. Same with all the other things that we were using. I mean, alcohol was a very common medication, whether you were in a regular doctor or a regular doctor. So I'm sure that people were using it as some kind of herbal remedy for a variety of different ailments.
How are things going with the book, by the way?
They're going really well, actually. Yeah, it's been really, really fun to talk to lots of people, and it's been getting a lot of attention nationally. And so,
yeah, it's been wonderful nationally. It's been just great.
Yeah, and it's fun to talk to people about medicine and hear, you know, crazy stories from their families too. And you know, I think that's one of the best parts. You know, I love this kind of quirky history. It's the history that I've always loved, and so it's fun to, you know, be able to explore it in a different way and talk to new people about it.
Yeah. What's this weirdest thing from your mind from the what you've learned in writing this book?
I would say, well, there's so many. I think one of the ones, I don't know if this is the weirdest, but it's one I like a lot. It would be weird if it happened to me. Lorenzo Fowler was a phrenologist who actually felt the head of his future wife to make sure that she was, you know, suitable for marriage. I can't even imagine. I mean, she was obviously, phrenology was pretty popular at the time, so it didn't seem like totally crazy. But I just wonder, like, what would have happened? Would he just been like, oh, this doesn't look so good. It was nice feeling your head. I don't know.
Oh, well, that's a great story, Erica. And wow, what a wonderful book. Thank you so much for coming by and talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's going to sell a million copies.
You said it.
I'm predicting. Erica Janik, our guest today, historian and author of many books, and it's been my pleasure to get to interview her, I think, about every one. This is her latest. It's called Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine. And it's, who's the publisher? The publisher is Beacon. Beacon Press. And do you have anything coming up in the near future, readings or?
I do. Yeah, I'm going to be at Arcadia Books in Spring Green on, I think, Sunday, February 16th. Is that 16th?
Yeah.
Then I'm going to be at Boswell Books in Milwaukee on February 11th. And I'm going to be at the Madison Public Library on March 5th. Those are all I can think of off the top of my head.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Erica Janik, wasn't it a fun? That was a really fun interview. That was a lot of fun. And I think the history of science is just fascinating anyway. Coming up next, we're going to learn about another fascinating aspect of science, and in a way, the history of all species. We'll visit with one of the featured speakers at this week's Darwin Day event. So please stay tuned here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.